direction of the woman, and the rim of the candle's reach touched what looked to be the hem of a scarlet skirt, which was hastily twitched out of sight. Where it had lain, the bare boards shone with fresh blood. He didn't advance any further, but listened for another pronouncement from the shadows. It came soon enough. Not the woman this time, but the Wheezer.
"The fault was yours," he said, "but the pain's been ours. All these years waiting for you."
Though corrupted by anguish, the voice was familiar. He'd heard its lilt in this very house.
"Is that Abe, love?" he said.
"Do you remember the maggot pie?"
the man said, confirming his identity.
"The number of times I thought that was my error, bringing the bird into the house. Tirrit would have no part of it, and he survived, didn't he? He died in his dotage, and Roxburgh, and Godolphin, and you. All of you lived and died intact, but me, I just suffered here, flying against the glass, but never hard enough to cease."
He moaned, and though his rebuke was as absurd as it had been when first uttered, this time Gentle shuddered.
"I'm not alone, of course," Abe Love said. "Esther's here, and Flores, and Byam Shaw, and Bloxham's brother-in-law. Do you remember him? So there'll be plenty of company for you."
"I'm not staying," Gentle said.
"Oh, but you are," said Esther. "It's the least you can do."
"Blow out the candle," Abe Love said. "Save yourself the distress of seeing us. We'll put out your eyes, and you can live with us blind."
"I'll do no such thing," Gentle said, raising the light so that it cast its net wider. They appeared at its farthest edge, their viscera catching the gleam. What he'd taken to be Esther's skirt was a train of tissue, half flayed from her hip and thigh. She clutched it still, pulling it up around her, seeking to conceal her groin from him. Her decorum was absurd, but then perhaps his reputation as a womanizer had so swelled over the passage of the years that she believed he might be aroused by her, even in this appalling state. There was worse, however. Byam Shaw was barely recognizable as a human being, and Bloxham's brother-in-law looked to have been chewed by tigers. But whatever their condition, they were ready for revenge, no doubt of that. At Abe Love's command, they began to close upon him. "You've already been hurt enough," Gentle said. "I don't want to hurt you again. I advise you to let me pass."
"Let you pass to do what?"
Abe Love replied, his terrible wounding clearer with every step he took. His scalp had gone, and one of his eyes lolled on his cheek. When he lifted his arm to point his next accusation at Gentle, it was with the littlest finger, which was the only one remaining on that hand.
"You want to try again, don't you? Don't deny it. You've got the old ambition in your head."
"You died for the reconciliation," Gentle said. "Don't you want to see it achieved?"
"It's an abomination," Abe Love replied. "It was never meant to be. We died proving that. You render our sacrifice worthless if you try, then fail again."
"I won't fail," Gentle said.
"No, you won't,"
Esther replied, dropping her skirt to uncoil a garrote of her gut.
"Because you won't get the chance."
He looked from one wretched face to the next and realized that he didn't have a hope of dissuading them from their intentions. They hadn't waited out the years to be diverted by argument. They'd waited for revenge. He had no choice but to stop them with a pneuma, regrettable as it was to add to their sum of suffering. He passed the candle from his right hand to his left, but as he did so, somebody reached around him from behind and pinned his arms to his torso. The candle went from his fingers and rolled across the floor in the direction of his accusers. Before it could drown in its own wax, Abe Love picked it up in his fingered hand.
"Good work, Lores,
Abe Love said. The man clutching Gentle grunted his acknowledgement, shaking his prey to prove he had it securely caught. His arms were flayed, but they held Gentle like steel bands. Abe Love made something like a smile, though on a face with flaps for cheeks and blisters for lips it was a misbegotten thing.
You don't struggle,
he said, approaching Gentle with a candle held high.
Why is that? Are you already resigned to joining us? Or do you think we'll be moved by your martyrdom and let you go?
He was very close to Gentle now.
It is pretty, he said.
He cocked his eye a little, sighing.
How your face was loved, he went on. And this chest, how women fought to lay their heads upon it.
He slid his stump of a hand into Gentle's shirt and tore it open.
Very pale and hairless. It's not Italian flesh, is it?
Does it matter? Said Esther. As long as it bleeds, what do you care?
He never deigned to tell us anything about himself. We had to take him on trust, because he had power in his fingers and his wits. He's like a little god, Tirit used to say. But even little gods have fathers and mothers.
Abe Love leaned closer, allowing the candle flame within singeing distance of Gentle's lashes.
Who are you really? Abe Love said. You're not an Italian. Are you Dutch? You could be Dutch or a Swiss. Chilly and precise. Huh? Is that you?
He paused. Then,
or are you the devil's child?
Abe Love,
Esther protested.
I want to know, Abe Love yelped. I want to hear him admit he's Lucifer's son.
He peered at Gentle more closely.
Go on, he said. Confess it.
I'm not, Gentle said.
There was no maestro in Christendom could match you for fates. That kind of power has to come from somebody. Who, Sartori?
Gentle would have gladly told, if he'd had an answer. But he had none.
Whoever I am, he said,
and whatever hurt I've done.
Whatever, he says, Esther spat. Listen to him. Whatever, whatever.
She pushed Abe Love aside and tossed a loop of her gut over Gentle's head. Abe Love protested, but he'd prevaricated long enough. He was howled down from all sides, Esther's howls the loudest. Tightening the noose around Gentle's neck, she tugged on it, preparing to topple him. He felt, rather than saw, the devourers awaiting him when he fell. Something was gnawing at his leg, something else punching his testicles. It hurt like hell, and he started to struggle and kick. There were too many holds upon him, however, gut, arms and teeth, and he earned himself not an inch of latitude with his thrashings. Past the red blur of Esther's fury, he caught sight of Abe Love, crossing himself with his one-fingered hand, then raising the candle to his mouth.
Don't!
Gentle yelled. Even a little light was better than none. Hearing him shout, Abe Love looked up and shrugged. Then he blew out the flame. Gentle felt the wet flesh around him rise like a tide to claw him down. The fist gave up beating at his testicles and seized them instead. He screamed with pain, his clamour rising an octave as someone began to chew on his hamstrings.
Down!
He heard Esther screech.
Down!
Her noose had cut off all but the last squeak of breath. Choked, crushed, and devoured, he toppled, his head thrown back as he did so. They'd take his eyes, he knew, as soon as they could, and that would be the end of him. Even if he was saved by some miracle, it would be worthless if they'd taken his eyes. Unmanned, he could go on living, but not blind. His knees struck the boards, and fingers clawed for access to his face. Knowing he had mere seconds of sight left to him, he opened his eyes as wide as he could and stared up into the darkness overhead, hoping to find some last lovely thing to spend them on, a beam of dusty moonlight, a spider's web, trembling at the din he raised. But the darkness was too deep. His eyes would be thumbed out before he could use them again. And then a motion in that darkness. something unfurling like smoke from a conch, taking figmental shape overhead. His pain's invention, no doubt, but it sweetened his terror a little to see a face, like that of a beatific child, pour his gaze upon him.
"Open yourself to me," he heard it say. "Give up the struggle and let me be in you."
More cliché, he thought. A dream of intercession to set against the nightmare that was about to geld and blind him. But one was real. His pain was testament to that. So why not the other?
"Let me into your head and heart,"
the infant's lips said.
"I don't know how,"
he yelled, his cry taken up in parody by Abe Love and the rest.
"How? How? How?"
they chanted. The child had its reply.
"Give up the fight," he said.
That wasn't so hard, Gentle thought. He'd lost it anyway. What was there left to lose? With his eyes fixed on the child, Gentle let every muscle in his body relax. His hands gave up their fists, his heels their kicks, his head tipped back, mouth open.
"Open your heart and head,"
he heard the infant say.
"Yes,"
he replied. Even as he uttered his invitation, a moth's wing doubt fluttered in his ear. At the beginning, hadn't this smacked of melodrama? And didn't it still? A soul snatched from purgatory by cherubim, opened at the last to simple salvation. But his heart was wide, and the saving child swooped upon it before doubt could seal it again. He tasted another mind in his throat and felt its chill in his veins. The invader was as good as its word. He felt his tormentors melt from around him, their holds and howls fading like mists. He fell to the floor. It was dry beneath his cheek, though seconds before Esther's skirts had been seeping on it. Nor was there any trace of the creature's stench in the air. He rolled over and cautiously reached to touch his hamstrings. They were intact, and his testicles, which he'd presumed nearly pulped, didn't even ache. He laughed with relief to find himself whole, and while he laughed, scrabbled for the candle he'd dropped. Delusion. It had all been delusion. Some final rite of passage conducted by his mind so that he might supersede his guilt and face his future as a reconciler unburdened. Well, the phantoms had done their duty. Now he was free. His fingers had found the candle. He picked it up, fumbled for the matches, struck one and put the flame to the wick. The stage he'd filled with ghouls and cherubim was empty from boards to gallery. He got to his feet. Though the hurts he'd felt had been imagined, the fight he'd put up against them had been real enough, and his body, which was far from healed after the brutalities of his Isordarex, was the worse for his resistance. As he hobbled towards the door, he heard the cherub speak again.
"Alone at last," it said.
He turned on his heel. The voice had come from behind him, but the staircase was empty. So was the landing and the passageways that led off the hall. The voice came again, however.
"Amazing, isn't it?"
the Puto said.
"To hear and not to see. It's enough to drive a man mad."
Again Gentle wheeled, the candle flame fluttering at his speed.
"I'm still here,"
the cherub said.
"We'll be together for quite a time, just you and I, so we'd better get to like each other. What do you enjoy chatting about? Politics? Food? I'm good for anything but religion."
This time, as he turned, Gentle caught a glimpse of his tormentor. It had put off the cherubic illusion. What he saw resembled a small ape, its face either anemic or powdered, its eyes black beads, its mouth enormous. Rather than waste his energies pursuing something so nimble, it had hung from the ceiling minutes before, Gentle stood still and waited. The tormentor was a chatterbox. It would speak again and eventually show itself entirely. He didn't have to wait long.
"Those demons of yours must have been appalling," it said, "the way you kicked and cursed."
"You didn't see them?"
"No, nor do I want to."
"But you've got your fingers in my head, haven't you?"
"Yes, but I don't delve. It's not my business."
"What is your business?"
"How do you live in this brain? It's so small and sweaty."
"Your business?"
"To keep you company."
"I'm leaving soon."
"I don't think so." Of course, that's just my opinion.
Who are you?
Call me Little Ease.
That's a name?
My father was a jailer. Little Ease was his favourite cell. I used to say, thank God he didn't circumcise for a living, or I'd be...
Don't.
Just trying to keep the conversation light. You seem very agitated. There's no need. You're not going to come to any harm unless you defy my maestro.
Sartori.
The very man. He knew you'd come here, you see. He said you'd pine and you'd preen. And how very right he was. But then I'm sure he'd have done the same thing. There's nothing in your head that isn't in his. Except for me, that is. I must thank you for being so prompt, by the way. He said I'd have to be patient, but here you are, after less than 2 days. You must have wanted these memories badly.
The creature went on in similar vein, burbling at the back of Gentle's head, but he was barely aware of it. He was concentrating on what to do now. This creature, whatever it was, had tricked its way into him. Open your head and heart, it had said. And he'd done just that, fool that he was. Opened himself up to its possession, and now he had to find some way to be rid of it.
There's more where those came from, you know, it was saying.
He'd temporarily lost track of its monologue and didn't know what it was prattling about. More of what? He said.
More memories, it replied. You wanted the past, but you only had a tiny part of a tiny part. The best's still to come.
I don't want it, he said.
Why not? It's you, maestro, in all your many skins. You should have what's yours, or are you afraid you'll drown in what you've been?
He didn't answer. It knew damn well how much damage the past could do if it came over him too suddenly. He'd laid plans for that very eventuality as he'd come to the house. Little Ease must have heard his pulse quicken, because it said,
I can see why it'd frighten you. There's so much to be guilty for, isn't there? Always so much.
He had to be out and away, he thought. Staying here where the past was all too present invited disaster.
Where are you going?
Little Ease said, as Gentle started towards the door.
I'd like to get some sleep, he said.
An innocent enough request.
You can sleep here,
his possessor replied.
There's no bed.
Then lie down on the floor. I'll sing a lullaby.
And there's nothing to eat or drink.
You don't need sustenance right now, came the reply.
I'm hungry.
So fast for a while.
Why was it so eager to keep him here? He wondered. Did it simply want to wear him down with sleeplessness and thirst before he even stepped outside? Or did its sphere of influence cease at the threshold? That hope leapt in him, but he tried not to let it show. He sensed that the creature, though it had spoken of entering his head and heart, did not have access to every thought in his cranium. If it did, it would have no need of threats in order to keep him here. It would simply direct his limbs to be leaden and drop him to the ground. His intentions were still his own, even if the entity had his memories at its behest, and it followed, therefore, that he might get to the door if he was quick, and be beyond its grasp before it opened the floodgates. In order to placate it until he was ready to make his move, he turned his back on the door.
Then I suppose I stay, he said.
At least we've got each other for company, Little Ease said. Now let me make it clear. I draw the line at any carnal relations, however desperate you get. Please don't take it personally. It's just that I know your reputation, and I want to state here and now I have no interest in sex.
Will you never have children?
Oh, yes, but that's different. I lay them in the heads of my enemies.
Is that a warning? He asked.
Not at all, he replied. I'm sure you could accommodate a family of us. It's all one, after all. Isn't that right?
It left off its voice for a moment and imitated him perfectly.
We'll not be subsumed to our deaths, Roxborough. We'll be increased to the size of creation.
Think of me as a little sign of that increase, and we'll get along fine.
Until you murder me.
Why would I do that?
Because Sartori wants me dead.
You do him an injustice, Little Ease said. I've no brief as an assassin. All he wants me to do is keep you from your work until after Midsummer. He doesn't want you playing the reconciler and letting his enemies into the Fifth. Who can blame him? He intends to build a new Isorderex here to rule over the Fifth from pole to pole. Did you know that?
He did mention it.
And when that's done, I'm sure he'll embrace you as a brother.
But until then,
I have his permission to do whatever I must,
to keep you from being a reconciler. And if that means driving you insane with memories, then you will. Must, Maestro. Must. I'm a dutiful creature.
Keep talking, Gentle thought, as it waxed poetic, describing its powers of subservience. He wouldn't make for the door, he'd decided. It was probably double or treble locked. Better that he went for the window by which he'd entered. He'd fling himself through if need be. If he broke a few bones in the process, it'd be a small price to pay for escape. He glanced around casually, as if deciding where he was going to lay his head, never once allowing his eyes to stray to the front door. The room with the open window lay 10 paces at most from where he stood. Once inside, there'd be another 10 to reach the window. Little Ease, meanwhile, was lost in loops of its own humility. Now was as good a time as any. He took a pace towards the bottom of the stairs as a feint, then changed direction and darted for the door. He'd made 3 paces before it even realized what he was up to.
"Don't be so stupid!"
it snapped. He'd been conservative in his calculation, he realized. He'd be through the door in 8 paces, not 10, and across the room in another 6.
"I'm warning you!"
it shrieked, then, realizing its appeals would gain it nothing, acted. Within a pace of the door, Gentle felt something open in his head. The crack through which he allowed the past to trickle suddenly gaped. In a pace, the rivulet was a stream. In 2, white waters. In 3, a flood. He saw the window across the room and the street outside, but his will to reach it was washed away in the deluge of the past. He'd lived 19 lives between his years as Sartori and his time as John Fury Zacharias. His unconscious, programmed by Pi to ease him out of one life and into another, in a fog of self-ignorance that only lifted when the deed was done, and he awoke in a strange city with a name filched from a telephone book or a conversation. He'd left pain behind him, of course, wherever he'd gone, though he'd always been careful to detach himself from his circle and cover his tracks when he departed. His sudden disappearances had undoubtedly caused great grief to everyone who'd held him in their affections. The only one who'd escaped unscathed had been himself. Until now. Now all these lives were upon him at once, and the hurts he'd scrupulously avoided caught up with him. His head filled with fragments of his past, pieces of the 19 unfinished stories that he'd left behind, all lived with the same infantile greed for sensation that had marked his existence as John Fury Zacharias. In every one of these lives he'd had the comfort of adoration. He'd been loved and lionized, for his charm, for his profile, for his mystery. But that fact didn't sweeten the flood of memories, nor did it save him from the panic he felt as the little self he knew and understood was overwhelmed by the sheer profusion of details that arose from the other histories. For 2 centuries, he'd never had to ask the questions that vexed every other soul at some midnight or other. Who am I? What was I made for? And what will I be when I die? Now he had too many answers, and that was more distressing than too few. He had a small tribe of selves put on and off like masks. He had trivial purposes aplenty, but there had never been enough years held in his memory at one time to make him plumb the depths of regret or remorse, and he was the poorer for that. Nor, of course, had there been the imminence of death or the hard wisdom of mourning. Forgetfulness had always been on hand to smooth his frowns away, and it had left his spirit unproved. Just as he'd feared, the assault of sights and scenes was too much to bear, and though he fought to hold on to some sense of the man he'd been when he'd entered the house, it was rapidly subsumed. Halfway between the door and the window, his desire to escape, which had been rooted in the need to protect himself, went out of him. The determination fell from his face as though it were just another mask. Nothing replaced it. He stood in the middle of the room like a stoic sentinel, with no flicker of his inner turmoil rising to disturb the placid symmetry of his face. The night hours crawled on, marked by a bell in a distant steeple, but if he heard it, he showed no sign. It wasn't until the first light of day crept over Gamut Street, slipping through the window he'd been so desperate to reach, that the world outside his confounded head drew any response from him. He wept. Not for himself, but rather for the delicacy of this amber light
falling in soft pools on the hard floor. Seeing it, he conceived the vague notion of stepping out into the street and looking for the source of this miracle, but there was somebody in his head, its voice stronger than the muck of confusion that swilled there, who wanted him to answer a question before it would allow him out to play. It was a simple enough inquiry.
"Who are you?"
it wanted to know. The answer was difficult. He had a lot of names in his head and pieces of lives to go with them, but which one of them was his? He'd have to sort through many fragments to get a sense of himself, and that was too wretched a task on a day like this, when there were sunbeams at the window inviting him out to spy their father in heaven.
"Who are you?"
the voice asked him again, and he was obliged to tell the simple truth.
"I don't know."
The questioner seemed content with this.
"You may as well go, then," it said. "But I'd like you to come back once in a while, just to see me. Will you do that?"
He said that of course he would, and the voice replied that he was free to go. His legs were stiff, and when he tried to walk, he fell instead, and had to crawl to where the sun was brightening the boards. He played there for a time, and then, feeling stronger, climbed out of the window into the street. Had he possessed a cogent memory of the previous night's pursuits, he'd have realized, as he jumped down onto the pavement, that his guess concerning Sartori's agent had been correct, and its jurisdiction did indeed halt at the limits of the house. But he comprehended not at all the fact of his escape. He'd entered number 28 the previous night as a man of purpose, the reconciler of the Imagica come to confront the past and be strengthened by self-knowledge. He left it undone by that same knowledge, and stood in the street like a bedlamite, staring up at the sun in ignorance of the fact that its arc marked the year's progression to midsummer. And thus, to the hour when the man of purpose he'd been had to act, or fail forever.
Chapter 9 1 Although Jude had not slept well after Clem's visit, dreams of light bulbs, talking in a code of flickers she couldn't crack. She woke early and had laid her plans for the day by 8. She'd drive up to Highgate, she decided, and try to find some way into the prison beneath the tower where the only woman left in the 5th who might help empower her languished. She knew more about Celestine now than she had when she'd first visited the tower on New Year's Eve. Dowd had procured her for the unbeheld, or so he claimed, plucking her from the streets of London and taking her to the borders of the 1st. That she'd survived such traumas at all was extraordinary. That she might be sane at the end of them, after divine violation and centuries of imprisonment, was almost certainly too much to hope for. But mad or not, Celestine was a much-needed source of insight, and Jude was determined to dare whatever she had to in order to hear the woman speak. The tower was so perfectly anonymous, she drove past it before realizing that she'd done so. Doubling back, she parked in a side street and approached on foot. There were no vehicles in the forecourt and no sign of life at any of the windows, but she marched to the front door and rang the bell, hoping there might be a caretaker she could persuade to let her in. She'd use Oscar's name as a reference, she decided. Though she knew this was playing with fire, there was no time for niceties. Whether Gentle's ambitions as a reconciler were realized or not, the days ahead would be charged with possibilities. Things sealed were cracking. Things silent were drawing breath to speak. The door remained closed, though she rang and rapped several times. Frustrated, she headed around the back of the building, the route more choked by barbs and stings than ever. The tower's shadow chilled the ground where Clara had dropped and died, and the earth, which was badly drained, smelled of stagnancy. Until she walked here, the thought of finding any fragments of the blue eye had not occurred to her, but perhaps it had been part of her unconscious agenda from the start. Finding no hope of access on this side of the building, she turned her attention to seeking the pieces. Though her recollections of what had happened here were strong, she couldn't pinpoint with any accuracy the place where Dowd's mites had devoured the stone, and she wandered around for fully an hour, searching through the long grass for some sign. Her patience was finally rewarded, however. Much farther from the tower than she'd ever have guessed, she found what the devourers had left.
It was little more than a pebble, which anybody but herself would have passed over, but to her eyes its blue was unmistakable, and when she knelt to pick it up, she was almost reverential. It looked like an egg, she thought, lying there in a nest of grass, waiting for the warmth of a body to kindle the life in it. As she stood up, she heard the sound of car doors slamming on the other side of the building. Keeping the stone in her hand, she slipped back down the side of the tower. There were voices in the forecourt, men and women exchanging words of welcome. At the corner, she had a glimpse of them. Here they were, the Tabula Rasa. In her imagination, she'd elevated them to the dubious status of grand inquisitors, austere and merciless judges whose cruelty would be gouged into their faces. There were perhaps one among this quartet, the eldest of the three men, who would not have looked absurd in robes, but the others had an insipidity about their features and a sloth in their bearing that would have made them pathetic in any garb but the most bland. None looked particularly happy with his lot. To judge by their leaden eyes, sleep had failed to befriend them lately, nor could their expensive clothes, everything charcoal and black, conceal the lethargy in their limbs. She waited at the corner until they disappeared through the front door, hoping the last had left it ajar, but it was once again locked, and this time she declined to knock. While she might have brazened or flattered her way past a caretaker, none of the quartet she'd seen would have spared her an inch. As she stepped away from the door, another car turned off the road and glided into the forecourt. Its driver was a male, and the youngest of the arrivees. It was too late to dodge for cover, so she raised her hand in a cheery way and picked up her pace to a smart trot. As she came abreast of the vehicle, it halted. She kept on walking. Once past it, she heard the car door open, and a fruity, over-educated voice said, "You there! What are you doing?" She kept up her trot, resisting the temptation to run, even though she heard his feet on the gravel. Then another haughty holler as he came in pursuit. She ignored him until she was at the property line and he was within grasping distance of her. Then she turned with a pretty smile and said, "Did you call?" "This is a private ground," he replied. "I'm sorry. I must have the wrong address. You're not a gynecologist, are you?" Where this invention sprang from, she didn't know, but it coloured his cheeks in two pulses. "I need to see a doctor as soon as possible." He shook his head, covered in confusion. "This isn't the hospital," he spluttered. "It's halfway down the hill." Lord bless the English male, she thought, who could be reduced to near idiocy at the very mention of matters vaginal. "Are you sure you're not a doctor?" she said, enjoying his discomfiture. "Even a student? I don't mind." He actually took a step back from her at this, as though she was going to pounce on him and demand an examination on the spot. "No, I'm sorry." "So am I," she said, extending her hand. He was too baffled to refuse and shook it. "I'm Sister Concupiscentia," she said. "Bloxham," he replied. "You should be a gynecologist," she said appreciatively. "You've got lovely warm hands." And with that she left him to his blushes. 2. There was a message from Chester Klein on the answering machine when she got back, inviting her to a cocktail party at his house that evening, in celebration of what he called the bastard boy's return to the land of the living. She was at first startled that Gentle had decided to make contact with his friends after all his talk of invisibility, then flattered that he'd taken her advice. Perhaps she'd been over hasty in her rejection of him. Even in the short time she'd spent in his Orderix, the city had made her think and behave in ways she'd never have countenanced in the Fifth. How much more so for Gentle, whose catalogue of adventures in the Dominions would have filled a dozen diaries. Now he was back in the Fifth, perhaps he was resisting some of those bizarre influences, like a man returned to civilization from some lost tribe, sluicing off the war paint and learning to wear shoes again. She called Klein back and accepted the invitation. "My dear child, you are a sight for sore eyes," he said when she appeared on his doorstep that evening. "So stylishly unnourished, malnutrition a la mode, perfection." She hadn't seen him in a long time, but she didn't remember his ever being so fulsome in his flattery before. He kissed her on both cheeks and led her through the house into the back garden. There was still warmth in the descending sun, and his other guests, two of whom she knew, two of whom were strangers, were sipping cocktails on the lawn. Though small and high-walled, the garden was almost tropically lush. Inevitably, given Klein's nature, it was entirely given over to flowering species, no bush or plant welcomed if it didn't bloom with immoderate abandon. He introduced her to the company one by one, starting with Vanessa, whose face, though much changed since they'd last met, was one of the two she knew. She had put on a good deal of weight and even more make-up, as though to cover one excess with another. Her eyes, Jude saw when she said hello, were those of a woman who was only holding back a scream for decorum's sake.
"Is Gentle with you?"
was Vanessa's first question.
"No, he's not," Klein said. "Now have another drink and go and dally in the rose bushes."
The woman took no offence at his condescension, but made straight for the champagne bottle, while Klein introduced Jude to the two strangers in the party, one a balding young man in sunglasses he introduced as Duncan Skeet.
"A painter," he said, "or more precisely, an impressionist. Isn't that right, Duncan? You do impressions, don't you? Modigliani, Corot, Gauguin?"
The joke was lost on its butt, though not on Jude.
"Isn't that illegal?" she said.
"Only if you don't talk about it," Klein replied,
which remark brought a guffaw from the fellow in conversation with the faker, a heavily moustached and accented individual called Luis.
"Who's not a painter of any persuasion? You're not anything at all, are you, Luis?"
"How about a lotus eater?" Luis said.
The scent Jude had taken to be that of the blossoms in the borders was in fact Luis's aftershave.
"I'll drink to that," Klein said, moving Jude onto the last of the company.
Though Jude knew the woman's face, she couldn't place it, until Klein named her Simone, and she remembered the conversation she'd had at Clement Taylor's, which had ended with this woman heading off in search of seduction. Klein left them to talk, while he went inside to break open another bottle of champagne.
"We met at Christmas," Simone said. "I don't know if you remember."
"Instantly," June said. "I've had my hair chopped since then, and I swear half my friends don't recognize me."
"It suits you.
Klein says I should have kept it and had it made into jewellery. Apparently hair brooches were the height of fashion at the turn of the century."
"Only as memento mori," Jude said.
Simone looked blank.
"The hair was usually from someone who'd died."
The woman's fizz-addled features still took a little time to register what she was being told, but when she grasped the point, she let out a groan of disgust.
"I suppose that's his idea of a joke," she said. "He has no sense of fucking decency, that man."
Klein was appearing from the back door, bearing champagne.
"Yes, you," Simone said. "Don't you take death seriously?"
"Have I missed something?" Klein said.
"You are a tasteless old fart sometimes,"
Simone went on, striding toward him and throwing the glass down at his feet.
"What did I do?" Klein said.
Louise went to his assistance, cooing at Simone to calm her. Jude had no desire to get further embroiled. She retreated down one of the paths, her hand slipping into the deep pocket of her skirt where the egg of the blue eye was lying. She closed her palm around it and stooped to sniff at one of the perfect roses. It had no scent, not even of life. She thumbed its petals. They were dry. She stood up again, casting her eyes over the spectacle of blossoms. Fake, every last one. Simone's caterwauling had ceased behind her, and now so did Luis's chatter. Jude looked around, and there at the back door, stepping out of the house into the warm evening light, was Gentle.
"Save me," she heard Klein imploring, "before I'm flayed alive."
Gentle smiled his sun-shamer and opened his arms to Klein.
"No more arguments," he said, hugging the man.
"Tell Simone," Klein replied. "Simone, are you bullying Chester?"
"He was being a bastard."
"No, I'm the bastard. Give me a kiss and tell me you forgive him."
"I forgive him."
"Peace on earth, goodwill to Chester."
There was laughter from all parties, and Gentle passed through the company with kisses, hugs, and handshakes, reserving the longest and perhaps the cruelest embrace for Vanessa.
"You're missing somebody,"
Klein said, and steered Gentle's glance towards Jude. He didn't lavish his smile upon her. She was wise to his devices, and he knew it. Instead, He offered her an almost apologetic look and raised the glass Klein had already put in his hand in her direction. He'd always been a slick transformer. Perhaps it was the maestro in him, surfacing as a trivial skill, and in the 24 hours or so since she'd left him on his doorstep, he'd made himself new. The ragged locks were trimmed, the grimy face washed and shaved. Dressed in white, he looked like a cricketer returned from the crease, glowing with vigour and victory. She stared at him, searching for some sign of the haunted man he'd been the evening before, but he'd put his anxieties entirely out of sight, for which she could only admire him. More than admire. Tonight he was the lover she'd imagined as she'd lain in Quaiswa's bed, and she couldn't help but be stirred by the sight of him. Once before a dream had led her into his arms, and the consequence, of course, had been pain and tears. It was a form of masochism to invite a repeat of that experience, and a distraction from weightier matters. And yet, was it perhaps inevitable that they found their way back into one another's arms sooner or later? And if it was, maybe this game of glances was a greater distraction still, and they would serve their ambitions better to dispense with the dalliance and accept that they were indivisible. But this time, instead of being dogged by a past neither of them had comprehended, they knew their histories and could build on solid ground. That is, if he had the will to do so. Klein was beckoning her, but she stayed in her bower of fake blossoms, seeing how eager he was to watch the drama he'd engineered unfold. He, Luis, and Duncan were merely spectators. The scene they'd come to watch was the judgment of Paris, with Vanessa, Simone, and herself cast as the goddesses, and Gentle as the hero obliged to choose between them. It was grotesque, and she was determined to keep herself from the tableau, instead wandering up to the far end of the garden while the banter continued on the lawn. Close to the wall she came upon a strange sight. A clearing had been made in the artificial jungle, and a small rose bush, real but far less sumptuous than the fakery surrounding it, had been planted there. As she was puzzling over this, Luis appeared at her side with a glass of champagne. "One of his cats," Luis said, "Gloriana. She was killed by a car in March. She was devastated, couldn't sleep, wouldn't even talk to anybody. I thought he was going to kill himself." "He's a strange one," Jude said, casting a glance back at Klein, who had his arm around Gentle's shoulder and was laughing uproariously. "He pretends everything's a game."
"That's because he feels everything too much," Luis replied.
"I doubt that," she said.
"I've been in business with him 22 years. We have fights. We make up. We have fights again. He's a good man, believe me, but so afraid of feeling he must make it all a joke. You're not English, huh?"
"No, I'm English."
"Then you understand this," he said. "You also have the little graves hidden away."
He laughed. "Thousands," she said, watching Gentle step back into the house. "Would you excuse me a moment?" she said, and headed back down the garden with Luis in pursuit. Klein made a move to intercept her, but she simply handed him her empty glass and went inside. Gentle was in the kitchen, rooting through the refrigerator, peeling the lids off bowls and peering into them.
"So much for invisibility," Jude said.
"Would you have preferred it if I hadn't come?"
"Meaning that if I'd asked, you'd have stayed away?"
He grinned as he found something that suited his palate.
"Meaning," he said, "that the rest of them don't have a prayer. I came because I knew you'd be here."
He plunged his first and middle fingers into the ramekin he'd brought out and laid a dollop of chocolate mousse on his tongue.
"Want some?" he said.
She hadn't, until she saw the abandon with which he was devouring the stuff. His appetite was contagious. She scooped a fingerful herself. It was sweet and creamy.
"Good,"
he said.
"Sinful," she replied. "What made you change your mind?"
"About what?"
"About hiding yourself away."
"Life's too short," he said, taking his laden fingers to his mouth again. "Besides, I just said I knew you'd be here."
"You're a mind reader now."
"I'm flourishing," he said, his grin more chocolate than teeth.
The sophisticate she'd seen step out into the garden minutes before was here a guzzling boy.
"You've got chocolate all around your mouth," she said.
"Do you want to kiss it off?" he replied.
Yes, she said, seeing no purpose misrepresenting her feeling. Secrets had done them too much harm in the past.
Then why are we still here? He said.
Klein'll never forgive us if we leave. The party's in your honour.
They can talk about us when we've gone, he said, setting down the ramekin and wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. In fact, they'd probably prefer that. I say we go now before we're spotted. We're wasting time making conversation
when we could be making love.
I thought I was the mind reader, he said.
As they opened the front door, they heard Klein calling them from the back, and Jude felt a pang of guilt, until she remembered the proprietorial look she'd caught on Klein's face when Gentle had first appeared, and he'd known that he had the cast gathered for a fine farce. Guilt turned to irritation, and just slammed the front door hard to make sure he heard. 3. As soon as they got back to the flat, Jude threw open the windows to let the breeze, which was still balmy, though the night had long since fallen, come and go. News from the streets outside came with it, of course, but nothing momentous. The inevitable sirens, chatter from the pavement, jazz from the club down the block. With the windows wide, she sat down on the bed beside Gentle. It was time for them to speak, without any other agenda but the truth.
I didn't think we'd end up this way, she said. Here? Together?
Are you glad we have?
Yes, I'm glad, she said after a pause. It feels right.
Good, he replied. It feels perfectly natural to me, too.
He slid around the back of her and, threading his hands through her hair, began to work his fingers against her scalp. She sighed.
You like that? He asked.
I like that.
Do you want to tell me how you feel?
About what?
About me. About us.
I told you it feels right.
That's all?
No.
What else?
She closed her eyes, the persuasive fingers almost easing the words out of her.
I'm glad you're here, because I think we can learn from one another. Maybe even love each other again. How does that sound?
Fine by me, he said softly.
And what about you? What's in your head?
That I'd forgotten how strange this dominion is. That I need your help to make me strong. That I'm afraid I may act strangely sometimes, make mistakes, and I want you to love me enough to forgive me if I do. Will you?
You know I will, she said.
I want you to share my visions, Judith. I want you to see what's shining in me and not be afraid of it.
I'm not afraid.
That's good to hear, he said. That's so very good.
He leaned towards her, putting his mouth close to her ear.
We make the rules from now on, he whispered, and the world follows. Yes, there's no law but us. What we want, what we feel. We'll let that consume us, and the fire'll spread. You'll see.
He kissed the ear into which he'd poured these seductions, then her cheek, and finally her mouth. She started to kiss him back, fervently, putting her hands around his head as he had hers, kneading the flesh from which his hair sprang and feeling its motion against his skull. He had his hands on the neck of her blouse, but he didn't bother to unbutton it. Instead, he tore it open, not in a frenzy, but rhythmically, rent after rent, like a ritual of uncovering. As soon as her breasts were bare, his mouth was on them. Her skin was hot, but his tongue was hotter, painting her with spiral tracks of spittle, then closing his mouth around her nipples until they were harder than the tongue that teased them. His hands were reducing her skirt to tatters in the same efficient way he'd torn open her blouse. She let herself drop back onto the bed with the rags of blouse and skirt beneath her. He looked down at her, laying his palm at her crotch, which was still protected from his touch by the thin fabric of her underwear.
How many men have had this? He asked her,
the question murmured without inflection. His head was silhouetted against the pale billows at the window, and she could not read his expression.
How many? He said, moving the ball of his hand in a circular motion.
From any other source but this, the question would have offended,
or even enraged her, but she liked his curiosity.
A few.
He ran his fingers down into the space between her legs and worked his middle fingers under the fabric to touch her other hole.
And this?
He said, pushing at the place. She was less comfortable with this inquiry, verbal or digital, but he insisted.
Tell me, he said, who's been in here?
Just one, she said.
Godolphin? He replied.
Yes.
He removed his finger and rose from the bed.
A family enthusiasm, he remarked.
Where are you going?
Just closing the curtains, he said.
The dark's better for what we're going to do.
He drew the drapes without closing the window. Are you wearing any jewellery? He asked her.
Just my earrings.
Take them off, he said.
Can't we have a little light?
It's too bright as it is, he replied, though she could barely see him. He was watching her as he undressed, that much she knew. He saw her slide her earrings from the holes in her lobes and then take off her underwear. By the time she was completely naked, so was he.
I don't want a little part of you, he said, approaching the bottom of the bed. I want all of you, every last piece. And I want you to want all of me.
I do, she said.
I hope you mean that.
How can I prove it?
His grey form seemed to darken as she spoke, receding into the shadows of the room. He'd said he'd be invisible, and now he was. Though she felt his hand graze her ankle and looked down the bed to find him, he was beyond the grasp of her eye. But pleasure flowed from his touch, nevertheless.
I want this, he said as he caressed her foot. And this,
now her shin and thigh. And this, her sex, as much as the rest, but no more. And this, and these, belly, breasts. His touch was on them all, so he had to be very close to her now, but still invisible. And this sweet throat and this wonderful head. Now the hands slid away again down her arms. And these, he said, to the ends of your fingers. The touch was back at her foot again, but everywhere his hands had been, which was to say her entire body, trembled with anticipation at the touch coming again. She raised her head from the pillow a second time in the hope of glimpsing her lover.
Lie back, he told her.
I want to see you.
I'm here, he said,
his eyes stealing a gleam from somewhere as he spoke. Two bright dots in a space that, had she not known it was bounded, could have been limitless. After his words there was only his breath. She couldn't help but let the rhythm of her own inhalations and exhalations fall in with his, a lulling regularity which steadily slowed. After a time he raised her foot to his mouth and licked the sole from heel to toe in one motion. Then his breath again, cooling the fluid he'd bathed her with, and slowing still further as it came and went, until her system seemed to teeter on termination at the end of each breath, only to be coaxed back into life again as she inhaled. This was the substance of every moment, she realized. The body, never certain if the next lungful would be its last, hovering for a tiny time between cessation and continuance. And in that space out of time, between a breath expelled and another drawn, the miraculous was easy, because neither flesh nor reason had laid their edicts there. She felt his mouth open wide enough to encompass her toes, and then, impossible as it was, slide her foot into his throat.
He's going to swallow me, she thought,
and the notion conjured once again the book she'd found in Esterbrook's study, with its sequence of lovers enclosed in a circle of consumption, a devouring so prodigious it had ended with mutual eclipse. She felt no unease at the prospect. This wasn't the business of the visible world, where fear got fat because there was so much to win and lose. This was a place for lovers, where there was only ever gain. She felt him draw her other leg up to his head and immerse it in the same heat, then felt him take hold of her hips and use them as purchase to impale himself upon her, inch by inch. Perhaps he'd become vast, his maw monstrous, his throat a tunnel, or perhaps she was pliant as silk and he was drawing her into him like a magician, threading fake flowers into a wand. She reached up towards him in the darkness to feel the miracle, but her fingers couldn't interpret what buzzed beneath them. Was this her flesh or his? Ankle or cheek? There was no way of knowing, nor, in truth, any need to know. All she wanted now was to do as the lovers in the book had done and match his devouring with her own. She reached for the edge of the bed and turned herself half over, bringing him down beside her. Now, though her eyes were besotted by darkness, she saw the outline of his body folded into the shadows of her own. There was nothing changed about his anatomy. Though he was consuming her, his body was in no way distorted. He lay beside her like a sleeper. She reached out to touch him a second time, not expecting to make sense of his body now, but finding she could. This was his thigh. This his shin. This his ankle and foot. As she ran her palm across his flesh, a delicate wave of change came with it, and his substance seemed to soften beneath her touch. The scent of his sweat was appetizing. It quickened the juices in her throat and belly. She drew her head towards his feet and touched her lips to the substance of him. Then she was feeding, spreading her hunger around him like a mouth and closing her mind on his glistening skin. He shuddered as she took him in, and she felt the thrill of his pleasure as her own. He had already consumed her to the hips, but she quickly matched his appetite, taking his legs down into her, swallowing both his prick and the belly it lay hard against. She loved the excess of this, and its absurdity, their bodies defying physics and physique, or else making fresh proofs of both as the configuration closed upon itself. Was anything ever so easy, and yet so impossible besides love? And what was this, if not that paradox laid on a sheet? He had slowed his swallows to allow her to catch up, and now, in tandem, they closed the loop of their consumption, until their bodies were figments and they were mouth to mouth. Something from outside, a shout in the street, a sour saxophone chord, threw her back into the plausible world again, and she saw the root from which their invention had flowered. It was a commonplace conjunction, her legs crossed around his hips, his erection high inside her. She couldn't see his face, but she knew he wasn't here in this fugitive place with her. He was still dreaming their devouring. She panicked, wanted to regain the vision but not knowing how. She tightened her grip on his body and in so doing inspired his hips to motion. He began to move in her, breathing oh so slowly against her face. She forgot her panic and let her rhythm once again slow until it matched his. The solid world dissolved as she did so, and she returned to the place from which she'd been called to find that the loop was tightening by the moment, his mind enveloping her head as she enveloped his, like layers of an impossible onion, each one smaller than the layer it concealed, an enigma that could only exist where substance collapsed into the very mind which begged its being. This bliss could not be sustained indefinitely, however. Before long it began once more to lose its purity, tainted by further sounds from the outside world, and this time she sensed that he was also relinquishing his hold on the delirium. Perhaps, as they learned to be lovers again, they'd find a way to sustain the state for longer, spend nights and days, perhaps, lost in the precious space between a breath expelled and another drawn. But for now she would have to be content with the ecstasy they'd had. Reluctantly, she let the tropic night in which they devoured each other be subsumed into a simpler darkness, and, without quite knowing where consciousness began and ended, she fell asleep. When she awoke, she was alone in the bed. That disappointment apart, she felt both lively and light. What they'd shared was a commodity more marketable than a cure for the common cold, a high without a hangover. She sat up, reaching for a sheet to drape around her, but before she could stand, she heard his voice in the pre-dawn gloom. He was standing by the window, with a fold of curtain clipped between middle and forefinger, his eye to the chink he'd opened. "It's time for me to get working," he said softly.
"It's still early," she said.
"The sun's almost up," he replied. "I can't waste time." He let the curtain drop and crossed to the bed. She sat up and put her arms around his torso. She wanted to spend time with him, luxuriating in the calm she felt, but his instinct was healthier. They both had work to do.
"I'd rather stay here than return to the studio," he said.
Would you mind?
Not at all, she replied. In fact, I'd like you to stay.
I'll be coming and going at odd hours.
As long as you find your way back into bed once in a while, she said.
I'll be with you, he said, running his hand down from her neck to rub her belly. From now on, I'll be with you night and day.
Chapter 10 1 Though Jude's memory of the night before was vivid, she had no recollection of either herself or Gentle taking the telephone off the hook, and it wasn't until 9:30 the following morning, when she decided to call Clem, that she realized that one of them had done so. She replaced the receiver only to have the telephone ring seconds later. At the other end of the line was a voice she'd almost given up expecting to hear again. Oscar. At first she thought he was breathless, but after a few stumbling sentences she realized his pantings were barely suppressed sobs.
"Where have you been, my darling? I've rung and rung since I got your note. I thought you were dead."
"The phone was off the hook, that's all. Where are you?"
"At the house. Will you come? Please. I need you here."
He spoke with escalating panic, as though she were punctuating his appeals with refusals.
"We don't have much time."
"Of course I'll come," she told him.
"Now,"
he insisted.
"You've got to come now."
She told him she'd be on his doorstep within the hour, and he replied that she'd find him waiting. Putting off her call to Clem and putting on a little makeup, she headed out. Though it wasn't yet mid-morning, the sun was blazing hot, and as she drove she remembered the monologue that she and Gentle had been treated to on their ride back from the estate. Monsoons and heat waves all through the summer, the doomsayer had predicted, and how he'd relished his prophecies. She'd thought his enthusiasm grotesque at the time, a petty mind indulging in apocalyptic fantasies, but now, after the extraordinary night she'd had with Gentle, she found herself wondering how these bright streets might be made to experience the miracles of the previous midnight. Sluiced of vehicles by an almighty rain, then softened in the blaze of sun, so that solid matter flowed like warm treacle, and a city divided into public places and private, into wealthy ghettos and gutters, became a continuum. Was this what Gentle had meant when he'd talked about her sharing his vision? If so, she was ready for more. Regent's Park Road was quieter than usual. There were no kids playing on the pavement, and though she'd had a hellish time carving her way through the traffic just two streets away, no vehicles parked within half a mile of the house. It stood shunned, but for her. She didn't need to knock. Before she'd even set her heel on the step, the door was opening, and there was Oscar, looking harried, beckoning her in. He answered the door dry-eyed, but as soon as it was closed and locked and bolted, he put his arms around her and the tears began, great sobs that racked his bulk. Over and over he told her how much he loved her, missed her, and needed her now more than ever. She embraced him and calmed him as best she could. After a time he controlled himself and ushered her through to the kitchen. The lights were burning throughout the house, but after the blaze of the day their contribution looked jaundiced and didn't flatter him. His face was pale, where it wasn't discoloured with bruises, his hands were puffed and raw. There were other wounds, she guessed, beneath his unpressed clothes. Watching him brew Earl Grey for them, she saw a look of discomfort cross his face when he moved too fast. Their talk, of course, rapidly turned to their parting at the retreat.
"I was certain Dowd would slit your throat as soon as you got to his order, X."
"He didn't lay a finger on me," she said, then added, "That's not quite true. He did later. But when we arrived, he was too badly hurt." She paused. "So are you."
"I was in a pretty wretched state,"